I don't know about you in the last number of weeks, but if you're like me, a lot of my conversations recently have revolved around things like, what are you doing this summer? What are your plans for this summer? Maybe you have kids in high school and they're graduating and you're asking them, you know, what are your plans when you graduate? We always want to have plans for what's coming up next. In fact, it's part of the expectation of our culture that we are planning ahead. We would look down on people. We do look down on people who aren't planning ahead. You know, think of, I've had conversations like this. How can she not think about, how can she not know that she's got to retire soon? Her body isn't going to hold up forever. She can't keep working this way. We start to look down on people if they haven't been planning ahead. Or, you know, what about, can you believe he died without a will? Like, did he not know he was mortal? Did he not know that this was coming? You know, there's a certain sense of, if you're not planning ahead, you should have been, right? This is just part of life. In fact, planning ahead is just good stewardship in a way, isn't it? God gives us time. God gives us opportunities. God gives us healthy bodies. And we have to make the most of what he has given us. So planning ahead is just good stewardship. It's responsible planning. And that's part of our passage today. But in everything that I've mentioned here, there's still something missing. And James puts his finger on it. So if you would join me in the passage, you'll see it up on the screen. I'll read it for us. James says, "Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city and spend a year there and carry on and in business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What's your life?" He says, "You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, then we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and does not do it, it is sin for them." A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I were in an adoption class, and it's run by Catholic Social Services, and they put three different groups of people in the room: the people that are investigating adoption, the people who are investigating becoming foster parents, and the people who are investigating adopting someone with whom they already have a relationship. It's known as kinship. And they have three different groups of us in the room, and so there are just times when the person doing the teaching is speaking to one particular group, and the other two groups are just listening in, and they're waiting for the speaker to address them more directly, but you're learning just from the speaker addressing someone else. The same thing happens in the book of James, and I'm sure you've seen this a number of times, and I'm sure Terry's brought it out. The letter isn't addressed to us specifically in every instance. You know, he'll say, "You rich," and then he'll address the poor. Well, these are clearly different groups that he's addressing at different times. He'll address the oppressors, and then he'll address the oppressed. This is just part of the nature of a letter, is sometimes you're overhearing things that aren't directly addressed to you. But nonetheless, you have a chance to listen in and learn from what the person is communicating to that other group of people. Same thing goes for us. But I think we are being specifically addressed by this group. Most of us in this room, I think we are specifically addressed today. Now, specifically, the people that James is addressing are a group of tradespeople. They're a group of people as a very narrow subsection of the community. They are traveling merchants. And so they are sort of people like Paul, the Apostle Paul, who was a tent maker. So he could pick up, go to Rome, or go to Athens, or go wherever it is that he needs to go to Corinth, and he could ply his trade there for a little while. He could pick up and leave. Jesus, another tradesman. We forget that Jesus was actually in the trades. I hope that validates some of you who might be in the trades. But Jesus was a tradesman. He could pick up and plant somewhere else and start over again. And James is addressing people like that. So you may hear this and go, oh, okay, so James maybe today, the parallel would be that he's addressing sort of small business owners, right? People who, or people who are in the trades. You know, they're working for themselves. They could sort of do this anywhere. Well, yes, but I think it goes beyond that at the same time. You see, the people that James is addressing are people like basically all of us in this room, because these people unlike most of the rest of the ancient world, have the opportunity to pick up and go somewhere else. They have the opportunity to do so. They have the means, the financial means, to be able to do it, and they have skills that they can employ elsewhere. How many of you are so tied to Red Deer that you couldn't possibly leave? Right? Very few of us, right? Like, probably very few of us are farmers, and we say our income, our livelihood, our very identity is tied to the very land here. Well, it's most of the middle class, right? As Walter mentioned, I moved from Hamilton. I wasn't tied to Hamilton to make an income, to ply my trade, right? And I'm sure most of you are the same. If Red Deer dried up tomorrow, we could probably move to Lethbridge, most of us. We could probably take a couple of weeks cut in our pay, and we could go somewhere else. We have means, we have opportunity, we have skills that can be employed elsewhere. So I think James is actually addressing most of us very directly. But if you don't find yourself in this situation, you are, like I just mentioned, one of those people who gets to listen in and hear what James has to say to this particular group of people, but to the bulk of us. So let's hear what he has to say. This group of people, James says, they're sort of saying to themselves, well, it's 2012, the Alberta economy is booming. It's booming, and I'm going to move one province over, and I'm going to get my slice of the pie. That's what these guys are saying to one another. They want financial security, and so they're willing to pick up and leave and go find it. And I get that. They want to pay off their mortgages. They want to start a nest egg. They want to make sure they're planning well for retirement, because it is coming. Maybe they're finally saying to themselves, the economy is booming over there, and if we go there, we can set ourselves up for success. You know, we could take that trip to Venice that we always wanted to take. We could afford to take our kids to Disney. Wouldn't that be great? They're saying to themselves, like, I can just see this conversation happening. They're saying, we can take control of our lives. We don't have to be under someone else's control anymore. And they're getting really excited about it. They're saying, what an accomplishment this would be. We'll be able to set an amazing example for our kids. We can show our kids that hard work and determination and sacrifice will pay off as we establish a life for ourselves. They want to set a good example for their kids. And you know what? I resonate with these people. I get it. I totally get it. This is me. I mean, I want to set a good example for my family. I want to provide well for them. So I sympathize with their plans. I sympathize with the conversation that Mr. and Mrs. are having together over whether or not they should pick up and move. Well, I get it. So I'm preaching to myself here, and you can listen in. How's that? James' response to these people. What does he say to these people? Look at it in the text. He says, you don't even know your life. He says, you are a mist that appears for a moment and then vanishes. Life is more uncertain than you realize, isn't it? James is saying that you just assume that tomorrow is going to look exactly like today and it'll probably be even better, right? That's the assumption that you're making, but you don't even know if you're going to get a tomorrow. He reminds them of that. He says, you're a mist. Life is short. It's brief. Parenting didn't come very naturally to me. I wrestled with it. I continue to wrestle with it. Our kids are 7 and 4 now. And I remember one time I was sort of complaining, woe is me, you know, this parenting life is really hard. And I was doing it around my Nana, who's in her 80s. And you know what her response was to me? These are the best years of your life, Benjamin. And me, in my own sort of pessimism, thought, so you're saying it's all downhill from here, right? Is that it? Is that what you're saying? It wasn't really helpful advice. But I remember having a similar conversation with Rob, our senior pastor at Unity, and he's like, yeah, I totally get that. He raised 4 kids. And he's like, I remember what those days are like. And his line was, the days are long, but the years are short. That was good advice. I needed to hear that. That's what James is saying, in a sense. The days might be long, but the years are short. You are a mist. We are going to appear briefly, and then we're done. And that's it. But But missed doesn't just imply that the years are short. It also implies that the years, person living through them, that you're fragile. And I'm sure Walter could share stories of what it's like in the ER and how often he is reminded of how fragile life is and how quickly one's life can change in an instant. James is reminding his readers about that. One author, her name is Feme Perkins, she writes this. I think it's a very insightful comment. In fact, I think it's probably the key to understanding this whole passage. She says that the readers may be so caught up in their own pursuits that they forget that they are radically dependent on God. They forget. They just forgot. And you know what? I get that. Once again, young parent, young kids, life is busy. Life gets hard. I mean, as I just look back on the past month and I think about all of the things that we've done, swimming lessons, play dates, maintenance at the house, cleaning up after that stinking storm, right? Netflix, that's a distraction. We have two careers. Both of us work full time. You know, I want to play slow pitch. I couldn't even make the time for it. I have elders meetings. We get the occasional date night. You know, life just gets busy. You know, book club, exercise, kids' homework, you know, planning for the next day. Life can just start to overwhelm you with the amount of things that you want to do and the amount of things that we have to respond to. So I get that it's really, really easy to forget about God, to forget how short life is. That is an explanation, but it's not an excuse. Life is busy. Yep. I'm busy. You're busy. That's the automatic response that we have when someone says, how are you doing? I'm busy, right? Because I'm important, right? It's an explanation, but it's not an excuse. Rather, James says, if it is the Lord's will, we will live. That's what he says that we should say instead. If it is the Lord's will, we will live. Have you seen the movie Grumpier Old Men? I love the movie Grumpier Old Men. And there's this one scene up here where Jack Lemmon is the younger, grumpier old man, sitting with his father, Burgess Meredith, and they're having a conversation. And it starts off with Jack handing his father a can, and the father opens it and takes a swig, and he's like, ugh, what's this? And Jack Lemmon's responds, oh, that's light beer. And, oh, what's that? And he's like, well, my wife, Ariel, she put me on a diet. You know, the doctor says my cholesterol's too high. And his father, this is his response. He says, let me tell you something about those so-called experts, those doctors. Last week, I turned 95 years old, and I've never exercised a day in my life. Every morning, he says, I wake up and I smoke a cigarette. And then for breakfast, I make myself 5 strips of bacon. And for lunch, I have a bacon sandwich. And for my midday snack, bacon, a whole plate of bacon. And I usually drink my dinner, he says. Now let me tell you about those flat-bellied experts. Those people say I should have taken a dirt nap like 30 years ago, but I'm still here, and those people keep dying. This is his line at the end. He says, sometimes I think God forgot about me. I'm still here because sometimes I think God forgot about me. Not according to James. We are still here according to James because God desires that we continue to live. God has not forgotten about you. It is his will that you go on living. At the same time, he is free to change his mind at any point. I might not live to see 35 in October. I might live to 95. I don't know. It is up to him. So do we feel like we have sort of a sense of entitlement to, you know, 70, right? To 70 years of good life? Is that what we think? You know, do we think if we get that news about cancer tomorrow, are we going to feel like God cheated us? I don't know. Do we have sort of a moral and religious entitlement that I am owed, God owes me these many years because I've been a good boy and I'm following him and I want to do what's right. You know, if we get the bad news, are we going to have what I call the karma reflex, which is, well, I actually didn't deserve this. Why is this bad thing happening to me? I don't deserve this. I've been a good boy the whole time. I'm supposed to get my just desserts. God owes me. You know, do we think that God owes us anything? You know, our thinking about the future needs to plan for our own contingency. We are contingent on God's desire that he continue to let us live. And good news for all of us here, today, he desires that we continue to live. We are not here by accident. You are not an accident. N.T. Wright points out in his commentary on this passage that ancient writers used to write this script, Deo Volente, and often what they would do at the end of a letter, say, these are my plans, Deo Volente. They used to even shorten it to just D.V., which means simply God willing. Latin phrase meaning God willing. I searched this online recently, and pictures that came up were mostly of ships. It's almost like someone named their ship God willing so that they, you know, get a little bit of luck, that their ship would actually make it to harbor. I found one picture of a horse. Someone named their horse God willing. I guess they wanted it to win really badly. We could certainly incorporate that phrase, though, God willing, a little bit more into our speech. Now, please don't do it too much, because frankly, I have one friend that does it. It's actually incredibly annoying, because we say, well, we're going to go for coffee at 5 o'clock, and he's like, I'll be there, God willing. And mostly it's just an excuse for because he's late. He's like, well, God willing, you know, God just willed that I was late. Well, I don't know about that. But whether or not this phrase, God willing, actually becomes part of our vocabulary, it needs to become part of our attitude. This is what James is reinforcing to us. We should at least be telling ourselves, if God wills and if God lets us live, then our plans will be to take our kids to Disney, to make our trip to Ontario in a couple of weeks. If God wills, maybe we'll pay off that mortgage a little sooner than we thought, or we'll start this new life in Lethbridge. We have to acknowledge that our plans are contingent upon God's will. You'll see this on the screen. One commentator puts it this way. This is Douglas Moo. He says, it's not enough, James suggests, to recognize that one's own life is uncertain and transitory. Now he's referring to verse 14, where James talks about your life is a mist. He says, such a recognition, after all, is not even specifically religious. What these people need to go on to reckon with is that their lives are also in the hands of God. This world, he says, is not a closed system. What appears to our senses, our touch and our taste and sight and smell, what appears to our senses to be the totality of existence, everything that there is to it, is in fact only one part of the whole. We've left out, in fact, the biggest part, he says. This life, Moo continues, cannot properly be understood without considering the spiritual realm, a realm that impinges on and ultimately determines the material realm in which we live from day to day. We are contingent on things that we can't see. We are contingent on God's desires, on God's will, and God's plans. But this group of people that James is addressing has forgotten that. And because they have forgotten it, it has led them into arrogance, because they think that they can sustain themselves. They are busy and ambitious, and they've forgotten God. And these lead to arrogance. So James continues. He says, you boast in your arrogant schemes. Boasting is evil. They're bragging about what they're going to do, and they're so sure that it's going to happen that it's like the money's already in their pockets. It's like they're probably already even spending it. And the way that we speak about these things, the way that we speak about our plans, as Jesus says, and as James has shown numerous times in this letter, they reveal what we're actually thinking and what our hearts are. What does Jesus say? Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. They're arrogant and ambitious, and they're bragging about it. They're bragging about their plans and how they're going to make money and they're going to set themselves up for success and everything's going to be great. And it's a way of saying we don't actually need God. We don't. They're actually going to take the credit for their own success. They've become self-made individuals. That's the way they think. Now, I have never heard someone in the church describe themselves as self-made. We're a little too careful in our language for that. But, you know, it creeps out in other ways. So I can think of conversations that I've had with people where they'll say things like, you know what, I did so well in sales that I can't even take new customers anymore. I just have repeat business. Yeah. And you start to hear about being self-made and the way that they've already set themselves up for the future. I think about students who say, you know what, I got straight A's, I got scholarships, the road ahead is looking great. I'm set up for success. I've done it. I think about people in the oil patch who make those sacrifices and work long hours and make big money because they're aiming for Freedom 55. It's been a long time since I've heard the term Freedom 55 in the media, but I see it here in Alberta in a way that I hadn't seen it until I came a couple of years ago. I see this in parents who brag about their kids' reading levels as though they are on the track to creating this kid who's going to go off to Oxford. Self-made. We have become successful parents. Here's the evidence. Our kid won the citizenship award. Look at us. That must reflect really well on us. You know what? Some of these examples are from my own life. Preaching to myself. So after James has described this, he goes on to make his point and drive it home with this generic proverb. Do you see it at the end of the passage? He says, anyone who knows the good that he or she ought to do and does not do it, to them it is sin. And you know what? I find this really heavy and a little bit depressing because I have enough trouble with those sins that I overtly commit. But now James is telling me that, oh, you've neglected to do a whole bunch of things too. And that's also sin. And that just sort of weighs on me. And I'm sorry, I can't really make that any easier for you or me. That's just the way it is, apparently. We are ultimately dependent on God's grace alone, and we are never going to earn anything better. The sins of omission and commission are what they're often called. So I love the Anglican prayer. You'll see this on the screen because it covers both of these things. I appreciate our Anglican brothers and sisters. They start off their prayer with, most merciful God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed by what we have done and what we have left undone. What are those things that we have left undone? We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. And then the prayer goes on to ask for forgiveness. What does James say? Anyone who knows the good that he or she ought to do and does not do it, to him or her, it is sin. And we have to confess that. We don't measure up. But what is the good thing that James is addressing in this passage? What is the good that he asks his readers to do? What has he just been describing? He's been describing people who have forgotten God in their plans. So what is the good thing that they need to do? They need to remember God in their plans. They need to allow for their own mortality and their own contingency upon God and his desires and his will and his plans for our lives. They have to stop living a life that demonstrates that they think, or at least have forgotten, that God even exists. They have to stop doing that and remind themselves that he does, and that his very existence and his very desires impinge on us and on ours. So as Rob at our church is fond of saying, how do we land this plane? You'll see a couple of images on the screen. It would almost be redundant for me just to go back over this passage. I mean, the whole passage is about application. But let me give you a few tips as to how you might make it more personal for yourself. Well, you could get a tattoo, Deo Volente, like you see on the screen. Or you could start reminding yourself regularly, Deo Volente, if God wills. This could become part of our vocabulary, part of our speech. You know, that would not be a bad thing. Please don't overdo it like my friend, but nevertheless. So when do you do your planning? I know for Chantel and myself, oftentimes it's Sunday afternoon after work is done. You know, I only work half a day a week. So when, you know, my work week is over, it was really rough 4 hours. We put the kids down on a quiet time or nap time, and then we put on a pot of tea, and we'll often have conversations about, you know, what's the week been like or what's coming up this next week. We'll look at our finances a little bit. We'll make sure we're doing okay here. We'll just talk about sort of the important things that are going on in our lives. So whatever your planning time is, whatever your tea time is, this could become part of the conversation. It should be part of the conversation. As we look ahead and as we plan, do these things fit with God's will? And are we submitting to what we know of God's will? That's one way to do it. Another way, if you don't, please pray the Lord's Prayer regularly. Your kingdom come and your will be done. And that line comes before anything else in the prayer that has to do with me and my needs and my desires. The structure of that prayer is really important. I think you guys pray this prayer here regularly. So I hope it gets into our blood. I hope it becomes part of our regular prayer life the other 6 days of the week. That prayer is about submitting to God's will. Lastly, if you have not read the book, please read the book, Practice of the Presence of God, or Practicing the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence, because he teaches people in very, very, very simple ways how to incorporate God's presence into our daily lives. Because the root of the problem in our passage, as we've mentioned, is that these people have forgotten about God. Well, it's pretty hard to forget about God if you've made it a habit of incorporating prayer with God and incorporating a sense of his presence into our very lives, into our daily life, as we are walking the kids to school, as we are cutting the lawn, as we're doing our chores at home. These people in the passage in James have made a habit of forgetting God. They need new habits. They need a new habit. They need some new habits that recalibrate them to God's presence with them on a daily, hourly, minute-by-minute basis. Brother Lawrence can help you with that in some really awesome ways. Psalm 16 has that wonderful line, I keep the Lord always before me. Now, the Apostle Paul says, pray without ceasing. It is possible. And Brother Lawrence can help with that. So I would suggest you dig into that because it's wonderful. Because if we live in conscious and ongoing communion with God in his presence, then when it comes to planning, when it comes to thinking about the future, when it comes to the things that we have to steward, well, we're already talking to God about all those other things. So why would this not be part of that ongoing conversation with God? It'll help us with our forgetfulness. And then, you know, when you go to your tea time, and you make your plans together, it'll be right there at the forefront of your minds. Practicing the presence of God will make a habit of remembering God. It will remind us to remember God. And as you have your tea time, so will the steam coming from the kettle. Let's pray. Lord, we admit that we are utterly dependent on you. For the next day, for the next breath, and for the strength to continue in the life that you give us. We remind ourselves that we don't sustain our own existence. Yet we admit that oftentimes our plans and our conversations reveal that we think we do. We think we sustain our own existence. So forgive us and help us remember that your grace covers a multitude of sins. Sins of commission and omission. Including the ways that we forget about you, and we live as practical atheists. May we live our lives being mindful of your presence, and may that growing life of prayer impact the plans that we make and the way we speak about our present and our future. Amen.